July 16th, 2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
And I'm Salome Chip Hessenflug.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
And we are back again for another adventure of Sherlock Holmes from the casebook, the last of the short stories. This one, The Adventure of the Veiled Lodger. This is back to form, right? This is really a Sherlock Holmes mystery, isn't it?
It really is. No, you go ahead, Chip.
Mm-hmm. I'm taking off my first veil as we answer this question.
Excellent. Now, you guys, I actually feel like it's really funny because the opening of this story basically tells us, hey, scholars of the future, you'll really enjoy reading Sherlock Holmes for lots of good reasons. Here's how Watson starts. When one considers that Mr. Sherlock Holmes was in active practice for 23 years, and that during 17 of these, I was allowed to cooperate with him and to keep notes of his doings, it will be clear that I have a mass of material at my command. The problem has always been not to find, but to choose. There is the long row of yearbooks which fill a shelf, and there are the dispatch cases filled with documents, a perfect query for the student not only of crime, but of the social and official scandals of the late Victorian era. Now, how many times in this podcast have we said, oh, this is such a great way to study the time period, to look at, you know, different kinds of social questions, psychological questions, questions of science, of epistemology, of philosophy. This is how you study the era, is by looking at your detective fiction. And Watson comes right out and says it. Like, I have so many stories to choose from, and you can study them. Here they are.
Not only does he come out and say it, but Doyle comes out and writes it. Like, this is out of totally left field, where we are getting the idea of Sherlock Holmes written down in a Sherlock Holmes story before we get to a Sherlock Holmes story. This is very interesting.
And he's also basically saying, like, the story I'm about to tell you is really going to tap into some Victorian anxieties, some social mores, some controversial questions of the day. And you know what, guys? We can just, let's list them off as we go, as we always do. We're going to learn a lot from reading this story. And it's like a pretty good story.
So we get pretty quickly from that interesting introduction into the actual case here. Mrs. Marlowe has a mysterious lodger who always is wearing a veil over her face.
Well, in fact, it goes on to say, was it 7 years she's been a lodger and has not been seen? And by the way, this is the second lodger that had had to be hidden away, right?
The second time that we see someone's living in my house, and I'm kind of curious about this someone. Hey, Mr. Holmes, could you figure out about this someone for me? Interesting. The milkman saw her face once, and he dropped the milk out of fright.
And Miss Marlowe also has accidentally seen her face, but only once. And it's interesting because she doesn't give any description of what she saw. She just tells you it was so horrible that the milkman dropped milk all over the street.
Isn't that interesting? It's certainly building that dramatic tension, isn't it?
And almost back to the Universal horror series.
Yeah, the disfigured character who has to hide his or her face because society would frown upon it. Yeah, this is very much in that 1930s movies. Yeah. Mm-hmm. She's a great lodger. She pays cash and she's quiet. There's no problem here, right? Did they live quietly? What were their personal habits? They were good boys, but they made a lot of racket at night. Are you the police? No, ma'am. We're musicians. Pam is staring. Nothing?
Reference. I'm sorry.
That's the Blues Brothers. Welcome to the Chicago podcast that you're a part of, madam.
Forgive me. Oh, dear. I'm sorry. So, I don't know anything about the Blues Brothers, but Mrs. Marlowe, she's this great concern. She says, her health, Mr. Holmes, she seems to be wasting away, and there's something terrible on her mind. Murder, she cries, murder. And once I heard her, you cruel beast, you monster, she cried. It was in the night, and it fair rang through the house and sent the shivers through me. So she's been there for 7 years, but lately she's been a bit more of a concern. And it's so funny because when Mrs. Merrillo was telling us this story, I was thinking she was going to say, set up that similar situation where, like, okay, can you guys hide in the closet and try and get a glimpse of her face and figure out what's going on? But then she goes on to say, now I talked to her and she said she didn't want to talk to anyone. I said, well, what about a clergy member or maybe a police officer? Since you're talking about murder. And she said, no, no, I don't want to talk to. And then Mrs. Merrillo says, well, what about talking to a nice consulting detective like that nice Mr. Holmes? And she says, that's perfect. So the veiled lodger totally knows that Holmes and Watson are coming. That's the man, says she. I wonder I never thought of it before. Bring him here, Mrs. Merrillo. And if he won't come, tell him I am the wife of Ronder's Wild Beasts show.
Hmm.
So it's such this a funny, like, I, it's so funny that Mrs. Merrillo didn't open with that. Like, hi, I'm here on behalf of someone who'd like you to come and meet her.
But right.
Ronder, like, sets up this whole story, like, wait a minute, didn't I read this Sherlock Holmes story before about this, like, unknown lodger? No, she's not only does she want to see Sherlock Holmes, but she has, like, a little catchphrase, Ronder's Wild Beast Show, that she thinks will get him interested if he's not already.
And for our listeners who are having a difficult time with Ronder's Wild Beast Show, just think Joe Exotic. You know, maybe
I
a tiger
knew
show.
You were going to say it. I knew it was going to be in there.
I wasn't expecting a Tiger King reference today.
Really? Really? We get on to Ronder's Wild Beast Show, and it didn't start strike you that Chip was going to bring up the Tiger King. Huh.
Available now on Netflix.
Sherlock has notes about the Abbas Parma affair. This was a small village in the Berkshires, and there was a caravan of circus performers that made headlines back in the day.
Yes, and he's pretty excited, and he's like, Watson, you remember this? And Watson's like, oh, really? Well, there was a North African lion named the Sahara King. King.
Not Tiger King. Not Tiger King. It's a lion.
How did you not see that coming?
I saw it coming.
Much like a Sherlock Holmes story, you know, there's lots of tropes. Chip's comments.
Chip's tropes.
It's true.
New show coming to Netflix.
Nicolas Cage will be playing the Tiger King.
Oh, jeez.
Oh, my goodness. So, there are two people, Mr. and Mrs. Ronder, and Holmes describes Ronder in such flattering terms. Ronder was a huge porcine person, and his wife was a very magnificent woman. And so, we get a little bit of a pig description, you know, just to get us started here. Now, they right. were the only people in the circus who were allowed to feed the lion. And Holmes explains, they believed that so long as they were the food carriers, he would regard them as benefactors and would never molest them. So when people believe that, you're like, oh yeah, that's going to work out really well.
Tell that to Carol Baskin's husband.
But there came a night the lion got out and attacked. Ronder was killed. Mrs. Ronder was terribly wounded. The other circus men, Leonardo the strong man and Griggs the clown, got the lion back into its cage.
Oh my goodness.
Holmes tells Watson that there was no other point of interest in the evidence save that the woman in a delirium of agony kept screaming, coward, coward, which is not really what you expect someone who's just been mauled by a lion to say.
Mm-hmm.
So then Sherlock Holmes was asked to consult on this case by a Constable Edmonds, a smart lad that. And Sherlock says that he and Edmonds sat down and smoked a couple pipes and talked about it. But really, nothing was done because it seemed like a pretty clear-cut case of a lion killing a guy and mauling his wife. Mm-hmm. But then I love that Holmes is like, when Edmonds and I sat down to think about this, we really thought about it from the lion's point of view. He says...
That's a great place to go.
Right? And we don't,
what would the lion do?
Exactly. We don't always get a lion's point of view in each of the Sherlock Holmes stories. So that's something I liked about this one. Here's Holmes. Look at it from the lion's point of view. He is liberated. What does he do? He takes half a dozen bounds forward, which brings him to Ronder. Ronder turns to fly. The claw marks were on the back of his head, but the lion strikes him down. Then, instead of bounding on and escaping, he returns to the woman who was close to the cage, and he knocks her over and chews her face up. Makes no sense. And we know how often Holmes does that kind of analysis about people, right? He's like, well, listen, why would this person, if they were about to leave, why would they turn around and do X? I mean, we have seen this exact trope about people like a million times in the canon. And so he's just making the same analysis of animal behavior. Humans are animals, and you can make good guesses about their motives just like you can about lions.
And it would not make any sense the way that it's presented here, but they couldn't make heads or tails of the case. And so the case went unsolved, basically. Just they said the lion killed him. Okay, moving on. Ronder was really a bad guy. He's another bad drunk here. He was a man of many enemies. Edmonds told me that in his cups, he was horrible, a huge bully of a man. He cursed and slashed at everyone who came in his way. This is yet again Doyle telling us the trouble with alcoholism.
And you guys, we are now into the prohibition era in the US. So there was no prohibition per se in the UK, but Doyle is definitely tapping into the fact that in the United States right now, where half his readership is, it is actually illegal to buy alcohol, and alcohol has never been consumed so widely.
You'll have to make your own at that point.
Exactly.
Holmes and Watson make use of a cold partridge and a bottle of wine before they head out to Mrs. Merrillow's house.
Now, Watson is feeling, I think, a bit whimsical when he heads out to the Veiled Lodger's house. And as soon as he sees her, he realizes that from keeping beasts in a cage, the woman seemed, by some retribution of fate, to have become herself a beast in a cage. But he also has an eye for beauty. And did you guys pause when you got to this description of the Veiled Lodger? I thought it was really interesting. Long years of inaction had coarsened the lines of her figure, but at some point it must have been beautiful and was still full and voluptuous. A thick, dark veil covered her face, but it was cut off close at the upper lip and disclosed a perfectly shaped mouth and a delicately rounded chin. I could well conceive that she had indeed been a very remarkable woman. Her voice, too, was well modulated and pleasing.
I'm going to quickly note this down, what not to say on a date. Probably not.
Well, he doesn't say it to her. He says he's telling the audience. This is something he's thinking, that she's got a beautiful mouth and chin, and her voice is beautiful. She was a beautiful woman before the lion bit the top half of her head off.
Yeah, just try that over dinner tonight, Steve. Let's see how that works.
With a woman who's had the top of her head bitten off? Okay. The lodger, whose name is Eugenia, was caught between two men. We have a love triangle at the circus here.
Oh no.
Her husband, Mr. Ronder, who's already been described as a terrible drunk and a porcine man, is even more horrible than we had imagined. From that day, the day she married him, I was in hell, she tells them. And he, the devil who tormented me. There was no one in the show who did not know of his treatment. He deserted me for others. He tied me down and lashed me with his riding whip when I complained. They all pitied me and they all loathed him. But what could they do? They feared him, one and all, for he was terrible at all times and murderous when he was drunk.
Wow.
This is a horrible guy.
Yeah, and the horribleness is highlighted here with that zoomorphism that we've come to see so often in Doyle's work, that idea, that Victorian era idea, that you can know someone's inner by looking at their outer characteristics. And the characteristics that Doyle writes for this man are just the worst combination of description here.
I was going to say, once again, this is just like a universal monster.
this definitely is a monstrous description. It was a dreadful face, a human pig, or rather a human wild boar, for it was formidable in its bestiality. One could imagine that vile mouth champing and foaming in its rage, and one could conceive those small vicious eyes darting pure malignancy as they looked forth upon the world. Ruffian, bully, beast. It was all written in that heavy jowled face. I don't know that I could think of any worse words to describe a person. This is every word to describe how awful this man looks, to describe how awful he is on the inside.
And a good example of how well Doyle has mastered the art of writing.
Oh, phenomenal writing.
Absolutely. Yeah. Now, I think it's really interesting to compare that to the description of Leonardo, who is very attractive physically. But listen to this careful description. She shows them a picture. He was clearly a professional acrobat, a man of magnificent physique. Taken with his huge arms folded across his swollen chest and a smile breaking from under his heavy mustache, the self-satisfied smile of the man of many conquests. You guys, that's a little bit different from like this pig-like wild boar man is obviously horrible. Because here he's very attractive. He has a magnificent physique. But I think the huge arms folded across the swollen chest, that doesn't sound fantastic. And that self-satisfied smile, I don't know. Like he's, this is an interesting description too.
And a heavy mustache. Who would want a heavy mustache?
Oh, Victorians. Victorians love heavy mustaches.
It's heavy. It's so heavy.
It's good for twirling. John wants
it himself, right? And it's a sign of virility, being able to produce tons of hair.
Wow. Wow.
But she also says, I know now the poor spirit that was hidden in that splendid body, but compared to my husband, he seemed like the angel Gabriel. He pitied me and helped me, till at last our intimacy turned to love. This is a very interesting love triangle, not at all like the Tiger King.
Well, how would you know, Steve? We'll have to watch it.
I don't know.
We'll have to watch it. And there is plenty of love triangles going on in Tiger King.
Of course there is.
And sardine oil.
Leonardo and Eugenia, they actually hatch a plot to make it look like the lion killed her husband. This is what she explains to Watson and Holmes. But however, the lion got out of control and ended up attacking her, at which point Leonardo turns tail and runs away. So she says, when I came to myself and saw myself in the mirror, I cursed that lion. Oh, how I cursed him. Not because he had torn away my beauty, but because he had not torn away my life. And you get the feeling it's not just because she's disfigured, which is a horrible, horrible thing, and she's in pain and she has a ton of recovery to do. It's also because the lion revealed that what she thought of, our intimacy turned to love, was actually not reciprocated. Leonardo does not feel the same about her as she feels about him. And at the same time, she cannot bring herself to turn him into the police. Like, she wishes she were dead, and she's still... So it's not like she's not keeping the story to herself because she doesn't want to be convicted of attempted murder. She can't turn him in. And that's something that's so sad, right? Like, that's an analysis of gender and sexuality. This is not a new story, right? People have done this a million times, and that Doyle is doing here, that she still loves this guy who is 100% unworthy of her love.
And the plot is not even attempted murder. They actually kill the husband.
You're right.
They
right.
create this paw thing that would mimic the pain that a man would have by being clawed by a lion, and they pound him over the head with it, and they kill him, and then they let the lion out, and the lion attacks her, and Leonardo leaves cowardly. Right.
And the only reason she's even telling Sherlock and Watson this today is because she just read in the paper that Leonardo drowned last month. So that's why she's revealing her story. And Watson
and,
is very...
And you guys are not seeing any of the Tiger King in this.
No.
Okay. Okay.
We're never going to see it, ever.
Okay. It's like the Tiger King, only with Sherlock Holmes.
Maybe okay. The Tiger King is like the Veiled Lodger, my friend. Think about it.
It could be. With a little Siegfried and Roy thrown in there.
Well, there you go. Now, Watson is... I think Watson and Holmes are both very moved by this story. And Watson says, "We sat in silence for some time after the unhappy woman had told her story. Then Holmes stretched out his long arm and patted her hand with such a show of sympathy as I had seldom known him to exhibit. If there is not some compensation hereafter, then the world is a cruel jest."
Isn't that old man Doyle there? Yeah. Talking about, you know, the karma of Christianity. If there's not some compensation after this life, then this world is a cruel jest. That's pretty deep, Doyle.
And then what comes at the end of the story, I think, is super interesting, because now she does admit to this consulting detective and his best friend that she has been thinking about taking her own life. So this is getting really, really dark. "We had risen to go, but there was something in the woman's voice which arrested Holmes's attention. He turned swiftly upon her. 'Your life is not your own,' he said. 'Keep your hands off it. What use is it to anyone? How can you tell? The example of patient suffering is in itself the most precious of all lessons to an impatient world.' The woman's answer was a terrible one. She raised her veil and stepped forward into the light." Now that is a really, really deep moment. Because think about this. So I don't always think of Sherlock Holmes as someone who like provides a lot of mental health counseling, right?
Mm-hmm.
And here's this woman. She's not talking to Watson, the doctor, at all. She's talking to Holmes. And he tells her, not like, "Don't kill yourself for money." He has two reasons she shouldn't kill herself. "Your life is not your own.
Keep your hands off it." I think that is a bumper sticker that I need to, that's a t-shirt that I need to make, because as dark as that is a thought, it's true. Your life is not your own. Your suffering is awful. We're not saying that your suffering isn't awful, but you would create so much more sorrow if you chose to destroy yourself. Keep your hands off it.
All right. So just think about it in a different way. What you just said, Steve, your life's not your own, and she's going to create more sorrow to who? Who is she going to create the sorrow for? So I don't think that to who? For who is this person? No. She's basically lived in a room for 7 years without anyone there.
Yeah, you guys.
She's a landlady.
So she.
No, I'm with Chip on this, Steve. Sorry. I think this is a theological thought. The idea that there's something greater than humans. And whether it's a Christian God, an Eastern philosophy, whatever, that your life doesn't belong to you. Someone gave you that life. And you owe it to live that life, no matter how difficult it is. That's how I read it, because okay. I'm with Chip. This woman doesn't interact with anyone. And Mrs. Marilow, bless her heart, seems like a nice landlady, but doesn't sound like they're close, you know? So I think this is an unexpected theological, philosophical turn by Holmes. And then his follow-up is, "The example of patient suffering is in itself the most precious of all lessons to an impatient world." He's talking about a 20th century that has just had a ton of new technologies. The speed of life is totally changing. We're entering the 1920s, time of modernism and futurism, where people are really like, whoa, the scope is changing. The world is getting smaller and faster. It changes the way we think. And Holmes is like, the fact that you live by yourself and suffer, that's actually, you're helping the world in a way that you don't even understand. Kind of deep.
This is quite possibly the deepest story ending that we've ever had. Wow.
In the casebook. Just throw that out.
Casebook. And again, this is the perspective of an older author who is thinking in different terms than a 30-year-old. Mm-hmm. This is a guy who's got some perspective.
Yeah, and then, which takes us to the very end. So then they leave. And 2 days later, when I called upon my friend, he pointed with some pride to a small blue bottle upon his mantelpiece. I picked it up. There was a red poison label. A pleasant almondy odor rose when I opened it. Prussic acid, said I. Exactly. It came by post. I send you my temptation. I will follow your advice. That was the message. I think, Watson, we can guess the name of the brave woman who sent it.
So wow.
This is really interesting that she took a couple days, right? Or she took a day before she would have sent it to think about whether she would take her own life. And then the words that Holmes said convinced her not only not to commit suicide, but to let him know that his words to her had that impact. And that is a very special thing. Like, that's mm-hmm. love. That's intimacy yeah. turning to love right there. Is saying to someone you don't know that well who had that kind of impact on you, thank you, basically. And I am sending you the poison that I had already purchased and was planning to take. You just saved my life.
Wow.
That is pretty amazing right there.
This is an amazing tale. This is as silly as this was at the beginning, as zoomorphic as it is in the middle. This is very poignant at the end.
And it's not really a mystery, right? But it's nonetheless a super satisfying story. Because the fact is, there is a mystery, but Holmes doesn't solve it, right? He's known about this mystery for years, 7 years, and he didn't solve it. And she asked for him to come and see her so she could tell him the story. Like, there's no detective work whatsoever, and yet it's a totally satisfying Watson and Holmes story.
Wow.
Pretty cool.
I'm completely floored by our conversation about a Sherlock Holmes story that contains no mystery, that Sherlock Holmes solves nothing, but the messaging is wonderful. This is wonderful. Huh.
I know. I don't know what you say at the end of this story. You're just like, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Like,
that's about it.
Yeah. So 57, this is our 57th Sherlock Holmes story. You guys, we only have 3 to go. We have 2 more short stories and then the Valley of Fear. So this is our 57th of 60 stories. And it might be the first time that we haven't left the podcast on a totally like goofy note, but that's how this story ends.
Well, I just pulled off my last veil.
Thank you. I knew we could get it back, you guys.
And tomorrow's story, The Adventure of the Shoscombe Old Place, is the last story that was published by Arthur Conan Doyle of Sherlock Holmes, chronologically. We still have another one to discuss after it in this collection, but chronologically, this is the last one that he published. So we'll have to
put a last bow on this one.
Yes, the last bow will certainly be on tomorrow's short story. I hope all of you are getting as much out of this as we are, enjoying these stories for what they are and for getting the strong messages here. Wow. We would love to hear from you. How are you feeling? Give us a call or a text. Give us an email, toomuchscrolling@gmail.com. Follow our hashtag TMSSherlockHolmes for all these conversations. And go to our dedicated Sherlock Holmes website, sandwiches@irregularhours.com, for the list of all of these that are just mind-boggling, just amazing to me. I am amazed. You have amazed me, sir. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
And I'm Salome Chepessis-Long.
And I'm Pam Bedour, and I am not watching the Tiger King.
Available now on Netflix.
That's not a thing.